Erbil, the capital of Iraq's northern Kurdistan region, in the early hours of Sunday. Initial reports pointed to the detonation of as many as 12 ballistic missiles. Then a statement came from Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. The force said it had fired powerful and precision strike missiles, targeting a strategic Israeli center for conspiracy and villainy. The IRGC said the attack follows Israel's recent crimes and promised that those atrocities would not go unanswered. The IRGC warned that further Israeli acts of aggression would receive a tough, decisive, and destructive response. Israel has long been blamed for a wide range of anti-Iran measures, including acts of sabotage against its nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iranian scientists. Former Israeli officials have also confirmed the regime's role in the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani in Iraq in 2020. And just last week, two IRGC officers were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Syrian capital Damascus. At the time, the IRGC vowed that Israel would pay for the crime. In 2018, Israel killed a number of Iranians during an attack on an airbase near the city of Homs in western Syria. Iran later retaliated with a barrage of missiles targeting Israeli military positions in the occupied Golan Heights. The missile strike on Erbil could be seen in the same light. Iraq's Kurdistan regional government officials have denied the presence of Israeli bases in Erbil, but the two sides enjoy friendly ties. Back in 2014, Israel bought Kurdish oil despite opposition from the central Iraqi government and threats to take legal action. 3 years later, Israel endorsed an independence referendum carried out in the Kurdistan region. And last year, Erbil hosted a conference on normalization of ties between Iraq and Israel, prompting a furore. The Kurdish regional government said it was not aware of the conference being organized. Some analysts believe Israel is pursuing several objectives in the Iraqi region.
Of course, they can also foment sectarianism in places like Iraq, you know, picking on individual weaknesses of people with the finances of the Americans or others. They can create, all sorts of divisions and hatred to create problems within these nations. And their primary purpose is really to encircle the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is the only nation and the most powerful nation that stands up for the oppressed in that region. And the primary oppressor in that region, of course, is Israel.
The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country. Words that will now sound even more reassuring to the nation and forbidding to its enemies.
In Paris, demonstrators gathered to warn that while the world is distracted by the conflict in Ukraine, pro-Zionists are stepping up their violence and oppression against Palestinians worldwide.
A steady trend of murders. I mean, 2-3 teenagers assassinated per week. Hundreds, if not thousands, of olive trees uprooted. Houses demolished, night arrests. It's going on continuously.
At the major pre-election dinner held by France's top Jewish lobby, known by the acronym CREEF, France's prime minister announced the banning of two pro-Palestinian groups. The administration of President Emmanuel Macron has falsely declared anti-Zionism to be the same as anti-Semitism, and has already closed many of the nation's top Muslim and anti-racist organizations. Many around the world have been shocked at the swiftness with which the West is sanctioning Russia for its military operation in Ukraine, noting that nothing similar was even remotely attempted to help Yemen, Palestine, and so many other non-white conflict areas. Unlike Ukrainian refugees to the European Union, Palestinian refugees aren't being awarded visa papers, the right to work, medical care, rights to housing, and other social services.
In France, the government, almost all the media, all the political parties immediately stand for Ukraine. In a way, they launch in a minute a practical BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions against Russia.
Western mainstream media and social media are openly encouraging armed resistance by Ukrainians against Russia, and yet resistance fighters in Palestine and other Muslim countries are called terrorists and subject to intense propaganda and censorship.
The double standards and Russophobia currently sweeping the West aren't just discrediting the West, they're providing a cover for far-right violence, oppression, and censorship. Many note that those aren't new policies for the West, and nowhere more so than in Palestine. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
As the vicious war in Ukraine rages on, refugees struggle to find somewhere, anywhere, safe to stay. The dominant media narratives are heavily focused on Russians and Ukrainians fighting each other. But here in Poland, Press TV found a unique exception. Meet Svetlana, a Ukrainian mother who fled Kyiv with her two children, Dmytro and Ksenia. They have been taken in by a native Russian who lives in Lublin with his Polish wife.
For me, it wasn't even choice. I just started to write to my friends in the messengers and suggest them help or hosting. And I think it's the only choice I had. I feel angry that I can't stop it, I can't help.
Svetlana was forced to flee as the fighting surrounded the city. Her family have endured a 630-kilometer journey through the freezing cold. She tells us the ordeal has been traumatizing.
After the war started, it was a great fear that hit us. The first thing I did was turn on the news. Then I collected just three suitcases and suddenly we had to run. We didn't know what to pack, what to eat, what medicine to bring, how will we cook, and what about school. To be honest, to be less stressed, I just turned off my feelings. If I had time to think about all the danger, I'd probably go crazy. The journey we had to deal with and the uncertainty. It was physically very hard, and I was only allowed to relax and cry once we escaped.
Poland has become a beacon of sanctuary for many refugees, with some 1.5 million already entered the country and many more on the way.
Unfortunately, the refugee crisis has now become heavily politicized, specifically in the English-speaking world. But behind those headlines are just ordinary people trying to get by. Regardless of whether they speak Russian, Ukrainian or Polish, the civilians all ultimately want the same thing, regardless of where they come from. An end to the war. Robert Carter, Lublin.
To remind the world of years of bloodshed and destruction by a Saudi-led coalition in Yemen, Sana'a University has hosted an exhibition displaying drawings and photos of the war with subtitles in different languages, including Persian.
We finished seven. Get inside the eighth year in aggression. So, as you say, they pumped all fertile facilities and they destroyed our infrastructure, and the situation has become dire and the health disaster, including malnutrition. So we may not the most affected group is the children.
During the inauguration ceremony, organizers praised the role of resistance media outlets, including Press TV, in supporting the Yemeni people and exposing the crimes being committed against civilians by the Saudi-led coalition.
Really thank Press for coming today. They're debating really a good thing. They're representing us in the Western countries, to the European countries, and also and we just come to the reality that we're really besieged. Through military stuff, through media.
Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed and millions of others have been suffering from the Saudi-led war and siege since 2015. Unfortunately, the mainstream Western media keep turning a blind eye to the crimes and violations against Yemenis.
Despite the wounds inflicted by years of the Saudi-led war, this exhibition proves that art and creativity are still alive in Yemen. Organizers say the exhibition gives a clear idea of suffering millions of Yemenis have endured. It is also an attempt to revive the conscience of the world, which has seemingly died along with hundreds of thousands of innocent Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A two-day summit of European Union leaders in Versailles, France, to discuss Russia's military operation in Ukraine concluded with increasingly belligerent rhetoric possibly overshadowing the rejection of concrete sanctions. Led by the Eastern members of the bloc, the EU will not impose sanctions on Russian gas and oil. In mid-May, a proposal could be unveiled to phase out Russian fossil fuels by 2027. The Western members of the bloc led the swift rejection of Ukraine's appeal for fast-track membership to the bloc. The EU and NATO claim they have excluded direct military intervention in Ukraine. The EU did double to 1 billion euros the amount of military aid for Ukraine. It's the first such military involvement for the bloc, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012.
There have been three strategic objectives which Russia did not anticipate. First, the resurrection of NATO. Second, the awakening of Europe. And third, the unity of Ukrainians. I think the Russians had a bad strategy.
Some in Europe are saying that Russia's military action is on the same level as 9/11 and that the EU must bolster cooperation on defense and drastically boost military spending.
Europe needs its own army. After the 1980s, Europe became disarmed and completely reliant on the Americans. Ukraine is the door to Europe, and now Europe has no choice but to arm itself. Europe needs to reconceptualize its own image into one where they can defend themselves.
If the EU follows through on some of these promises and sanctions, Europe will likely see a multi-year effect on prices of food, energy, and basic goods. The green transition, which some think is so vital, will likely need to be reversed. The summit ends much as it began. It's not fully clear how far the EU will go to get involved in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
A poll last month showed that two-thirds of France is favorable to organizing a referendum on leaving the European Union. If massive and controversial changes aren't approved by a democratic vote, it's possible that the EU may be fomenting even more discord. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As Yemenis experienced the worst fuel shortage since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in 2015, Yemen's petroleum company held a press conference to highlight the impact of the Saudi piracy acts in the Red Sea.
In 2021, the Saudi-led coalition prevented entry of fuel needed to meet 95% of the general need for fuel. This shows that the Saudi-led coalition uses fuel as a pressure card amid the ongoing war. This is a clear violation of the international humanitarian law. The situation is dangerous, especially with the rise of oil prices internationally due to the Russian-Ukrainian conflict.
Officials say the purpose of the Saudi-led coalition's seizure of fuel ships is to raise the price of fuel and spread chaos in the country.
The Saudi-led coalition is continuing its siege intending to raise fuel prices. They believe the rise in fuel prices will force people to go out to the streets and protest. But the Yemenis have proven to the Saudi-led coalition that they know who causes the fuel crisis and they hold the United Nations responsible for its continued silence.
Besides the war, Saudi Arabia and its allies have imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, but it has not taken any action to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis.
Experts believe Saudi Arabia's recent measures to block Yemen's fuel imports are yet another proof that the Saudi military operation against Yemen is a failure. And they also say the Russia-Ukraine conflict has exposed the international community's double standard on humanitarian crisis. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to Thee, to be joyful in worshipping Thee, to be desirous of Thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me Thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom Thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
As many as 81 prisoners executed in a single day. That is what Saudi Arabia has done, and what it said were terror-related offenses. But why would Saudi Arabia decide to do this many executions in one day, knowing the controversy and uproar that it would cause? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will examine the reasons behind these mass executions, which included dozens of Shia dissidents, and then look at the double standards of Western countries that support Saudi Arabia, yet look the other way when it comes to its crimes.
Saudi Arabia has put 81 prisoners to death on a single day in one of the kingdom's biggest executions in decades. The figure has dwarfed the number of those executed in the country the whole of last year. More than half of those executed were Shia Muslims, including teenagers from the restive Qatif region. The convicts also included members of Yemen's Ansarullah movement. Riyadh has cited terrorism-related crimes as pretext for the recent executions. The prisoners face a wide range of accusations, such as attempting to assassinate security officers, targeting police stations, plotting attacks on vital places, and smuggling weapons into the kingdom, as well as cooperating with Daesh and Al-Qaeda terror groups. No court documents have been made public that could verify those allegations. Human rights groups have slammed the killings, saying there were prisoners sentenced to death for non-violent crimes. Human rights advocates have also criticized the kingdom for denying inmates their basic rights.
They use any type of pretext to, silence anybody or imprison anybody. And at the same time, these prisoners don't even have basic rights to, for instance, even get a lawyer to represent them.
The brutal act has drawn criticism in the region and beyond. Iran has called it an inhumane act that violated the basic human rights principles and international law. The Iranian president has slammed Western countries' double standards as well as silence and inaction of self-proclaimed human rights advocates regarding the execution of innocent people. Raisi says this proves those countries use human rights as a political tool to serve their own interests and against independent states. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has also slammed the Saudi execution of inmates as a heinous crime. It accused Riyadh of practicing the ugliest forms of sectarian discrimination. The Yemeni Committee for Prisoners of War has condemned the mass killings, warning of serious consequences for the Al Saud regime. The kingdom is also involved in extrajudicial executions beyond its borders. Brutal killing and dismemberment of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018 is one of the many instances. Despite conclusions by intelligence agencies that Crown Prince and Kingdom's de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman personally ordered the assassination, Washington and its Western allies have shied away from holding Riyadh, MBS in particular, to account for the barbaric act. Saudi Arabia has a long history of mass executions of political prisoners. The kingdom's last mass execution occurred in early January 2016 when 47 people, including prominent opposition Shia cleric Sheikh Nimr Baqir al-Nimr, were executed without being fairly tried. Sheikh Nimr's only crime was his call for anti-regime and pro-democracy protests. Rights groups have also cited the rampant cases of torture of prisoners and unfair trials. They say Saudi Arabia uses the death penalty as a political weapon to punish those who dare to protest against their treatment and to frighten others into silence. The kingdom's brutal executions of political prisoners have, however, been met with a deafening silence by Western countries, self-proclaimed advocates of human rights.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, writer and political analyst John White, joins us from Edinburgh. Also joining us is activist and political commentator Leif Maruf, who joins us from Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Laith Maruf, let me first start with you and ask a question and, of course, your reaction to what has happened. We're looking at 81 prisoners that were executed in a single day, and this comes pretty much right before Ramadan. Why do you think Saudi Arabia, first of all, went ahead with this many executions in one day when it could have spread that over a period of time, but obviously it decided not to do that?
I mean, we know that 41 out of those 81 were Shia from the Qatif region in the east where all the oil is. We know that the Shia population of Saudi-occupied Arabia amounts to around 1% of the population. And as we saw, you know, got over 50% of the executions. Many of those who were executed, as you correctly pointed out, were arrested as underage when they were arrested a while ago. One of them was a 13-year-old child when he was arrested. Another, we know that one of those who were executed, the only crime that he was accused of was owning a picture of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah. So that tells you how arbitrary these executions were. But putting it in light of the regional developments that we've seen in the past few weeks, we understand that the intent of these executions was not only to frighten and terrorize the Shia population of the East Coast, but actually it's a message to the axis of resistance, because ultimately, inside the kingdom of Saud, there is no real opposition. The regime controls almost every aspect of life, and those who are opposing it will not be presenting much of a, you know, opposition. So why now? It is clear that this is trying to poke at Iran, trying to poke at Ansarullah in Yemen and Hezbollah in Lebanon. And we saw the immediate reaction of the Iranian government cutting off any future discussions of negotiations with the Saudi kingdom until some respite from this massacre.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting point that you make there in terms of the timing. John White, so what do you think? I mean, we're looking at what our guest there in Beirut says, that this is to poke Iran, to send a message to the axis of resistance, in particular Hezbollah, who, by the way, has said that this brings forth the true face of the Saudi regime, which practices the ugliest forms of sectarian discrimination. Do you think that then there were multi-purposes behind the executions, similar to what our guest there said?
Yeah, there was definitely an external and an internal dynamic and motive behind these executions. And the timing is particularly interesting because this was clearly, in my view, timed to coincide with the eyes of the world being on Ukraine and the conflict taking place there. So Bin Salman probably thought he could get this through, because at the same time as he was murdering these poor wretches, Boris Johnson, Prime Minister of the UK, and Joe Biden, President of the US, were abasing themselves at his feet to try and persuade him to pump more oil to offset the sanctions placed on Russia's energy sector and the concomitant rise in energy prices on the world market. So he knows he can get away with it. This Roman spectacle of savagery is another reminder that Saudi Arabia, like Israel, enjoys exceptional status in the West, which translate into both countries being able to murder with impunity, knowing that because of their strategic value, so-called, to the Western ideological bloc, that they will get no kind of traction, there will be no pushback, and there will certainly be no accountability. So I am appalled at this level of savagery. Mohammed bin Salman is leading a mafia clique in Riyadh. I've said it before, Saudi Arabia is not a state, it's a family business whose primary business is murder. And it really does shine a harsh light on the sheer hypocrisy of Western governments that are never done lecturing other countries around the world about human rights, including Iran.
You talked about, Laith Maarouf, the eastern province where the Qatif region lies, where the oil is produced, and the marginalization that happens there. I can't even call it marginalization based on what has happened with these executions, which has been a target for the Saudi regime to target that area, which includes actually decimating lots of the, or destroying lots of the structures there. Why is the eastern province, which is largely populated by the Shia minority, if you want to call it that, to be a target for the Saudi government and its security forces?
I mean, obviously, since the beginning of the Saudi government, as we know it, a state as we know it, the biggest threat to them was the existence of the Shia minority in the East Coast, where all the oil resources exist. If we are to follow the logic of the United States and the West, which says every minority in whatever region, in whatever country, should have its own state, then obviously if these Shia populations revolt and create their own state, the Saudi kingdom will have zero resources in terms of oil and will be back to its origin of irrelevance on the global scene and the regional scene. So the Saudi government keeps a lot of attention on the population in the East Coast because of this delicate situation that the whole state rests on the resources being extracted from under these people. Therefore, there will be a clampdown constantly on this population to make sure that they don't organize and are not able to send their voice out. It's very interesting that my colleague brought up the visit of Boris Johnson that is expected to the kingdom any day now to beg for more oil. And we know President Biden attempted to speak to MBS and the Emiratis and was rejected the call. We have to obviously put this in the context of the international developments, that as the empire becomes more desperate for resources, and it's this weakens its control over its vassals and provinces, and therefore we will see more, arbitrary actions by the vassals, like the Saudis, like the Israelis, that the Americans haven't calculated. This is because it increases the margin of maneuverability for these vassals. And as we see right now, the Saudi regime is trying to extract as much of a price for this oil that they will be giving to the empire to sustain it during the war against Russia, between Russia and Ukraine.
Well, when you talk about what you did, John White, about the way that Western countries have actually pretty much looked the other way when it comes to the way that Saudi kingdom has exercised dissent, pretty much crushing it in terms of any type of opposition that comes. Do you think that right now there might be more of a spotlight on this because we're looking at the way that the West needs Saudi Arabia, and like the visit by Boris Johnson, and of course the U.S. reaching out to Saudi Arabia, even though calls were not returned from what we understand, this continuation will further embolden Saudi Arabia to continue with what it's been doing, which it's been doing this now for years.
Indeed, true. But we must understand that this is not the actions of a strong leader. This is the savagery of a weak leader. Saudi Arabia is a very unstable country. It has a constituency, mainly younger people who are aspiring for reforms, and there is a reform agenda that's being pursued by MBS as we speak. And also the ultra-conservatives, the Salafists, the Wahhabists, the people of a conservative mindset, and some recalcitrant princes. So the only way this country goes, these two forces or these two demographics are irreconcilable. And so the only way that they can be held together is through terror. And terror is the go-to actions of a weak leader who's not secure in his power. He knows his people don't love him. He knows there are recalcitrant princes who are keeping an eye to see if they can see any sign of weakness which they can exploit. The war in Yemen is going catastrophically for the Saudis. After 7 years, they failed to achieve their strategic objectives. So this has been shown up to be a very weak and unstable power. And this is MBS trying to reassert domination over the Saudi masses and also take advantage, as you rightly say, of the West desperation and the need for Saudi oil and the need for Saudi as an arms customer of West, which is massive. The Saudis are the largest single biggest recipient of British arms sales and the largest biggest recipient of US arms sales. It's like a dripping roast for the West. And this is about greed, it's about geostrategic advantage, but I think this is starting to redound to the disadvantage of the West, because people all across the global South can see the rank hypocrisy of these Western governments. And that's why China and Russia is gaining more support and more influence in that part of the world, precisely because of that.
Right. Well, Laith Maruf, we need to nitpick a little bit about what there is, if there even is, a judicial process, quote-unquote, which there really isn't, based on many factors. But we're looking at Saudi Arabia to have labeled these terrorism-related charges. But there are questions about this so-called judicial process that exists in Saudi Arabia. Perhaps you can tell us what that may be, because we're looking really at political opposition and dissent being crushed. Also, when Saudi Arabia back in 2008 redefined its anti-terrorism law, which then, based on analysts, their conclusion was that it can target anybody based on that law and put him in jail. So are we looking at a broken system that's really not even a system?
Yes, I mean, this is a regime of terror that has been in power using brute terror since its existence and the backing of the British and the Americans since the 40s. And therefore, you know, the whole world has, specifically the West, have kept a close eye and looked the other way for as long as this regime existed, as long as it allows the oil to be pumped cheaply to the West and make sure that any unification or progressive movements in the region do not flourish. Looking at the way that the West is dealing with this, I think everybody that's in the propaganda arms of the empire and in the strategic analysis and drawing up plans of the empire, they know exactly that all they are doing in Ukraine and what they're doing in Palestine and in this situation in Yemen is weakening their ability to propagate this idea of democracy and human rights and that the West is the leader of it. But at this moment, the empire is desperate and it's not willing to care for these details because, you know, the window of the rise of China to becoming the number one economic power in the world and the escape of Russia from the hold of the West is closing very shortly. And at any moment, it's the end of the empire. So where we see that the empire doesn't care really about its own propaganda when it's dealing with Ukraine, even though it is weakening its propaganda around the issues of Palestine or Yemen or the whole Western Asia situation. And that's a gamble, and the West is going to pay for it dearly.
Yeah, this has been brought up, and it may be straying off the subject of our program, but John White, maybe we could just talk about it a little briefly, because we're looking at a geopolitical shift that's happening here based on the fact that the U.S., or as our guest says, the empire altogether, perhaps, is weakening, it's withdrawing itself from the West Asia region, but in particular, countries in this region are not that keen to be aligned with the U.S. that much anyways. So we're looking at this perhaps realignment that's taking place, or a pivot, if you want to call it, towards the East. Does that mean that they feel like they can do what they want, and then if they want to cooperate with the West, that that's their decision, that they will no longer be driven by them?
Indeed, there's an increasing assertion of national sovereignty. Hitherto, national sovereignty would be dispensed by Washington at its whim on vassal states. That's changing now. Since the disaster of Iraq in 2003, US power has declined incrementally, and now the empire has entered its mad dog days. We're even having talk now amongst Western ideologues, would you believe, on mainstream news channels and in mainstream newspapers about the possibility of a nuclear war, as if that's something that can even be contemplated. This is the desperation of an empire and its acolytes that is it's entering its mad dog days, as I say. When an empire is safe in its power, it creates its own reality. But when that power wanes, as it must, that reality is revealed to be the product of magical thinking and thereby the very antithesis of reality. And that's what we're seeing playing out now. We've entered a period of interregnum between the dying of the old world and the full flowering coming into being of the new. That's what's being fought over in Ukraine as we speak, and a great decoupling is being accelerated in consequence of this conflict between East and West. So yes, states across the global south are now looking to new countries, they're now looking to new developmental models when it comes to developing their own economies, but be in no doubt that the West, this empire will not go into that good night without a strong fight. And so I'm concerned about the prospects for a major conflagration between the major powers, including Russia, over Ukraine, that will drag in other countries, i.e. China, and perhaps the regional allies such as Iran and obviously Venezuela. Mm-hmm. But it's a good thing going forward for the world, because what we've been living through is completely unsustainable. Since the demise of the Soviet Union, we've lived under the iron heel of this Western bloc. And the problem with Western ideologues is what colonizes their minds is that the West is a latter-day Rome to Russia's latter-day Carthage. And Cartago, Delenda Est, Cato the Elder used to state after his speeches after the Second Punic War, Carthage must be destroyed. For Western ideologues, it's a case of Russia and increasingly China must be destroyed. So we're entered a very interesting time in human affairs.
Indeed. The executions have, in a way, also shed light here, Laith Maruf, on the Saudi crown prince. Ever since he has come, we have seen dozens of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, Muslim scholars even, to have been executed, women's rights campaigners to be put behind bars. But he's the shining light for Saudi Arabia, and the West is promoting him. Of course, there's the Khashoggi incident, which in a way is an execution also. Doesn't this mass execution prove that all these claims of reform are really just empty propaganda?
Yes, definitely they're empty propaganda. And if you notice, really, what the West was trying to do is recycle the image of the Saudi regime and MBS in return for this regime openly normalizing with the Zionist colony. And therefore, as we saw in Ukraine, as long as you're on the side of the Zionist, you're allowed to be a Nazi. Similarly, if you're on the side of a Zionist in the Gulf, you're allowed to be a dictator, a Wahhabi, a cultist, you know, a pedophile, what have you, as long as you're on the side of Israel. So ultimately, this recycling and of the image of MBS and the Saudis was hinged on the normalization of the Saudi regime with the Zionists in the public, which hasn't happened yet because the smaller actors that the Saudis control, like the UAE and Bahrain and Morocco and what have you, are under a lot of pressure as the first stage of normalization from their own public. And I don't think the Saudis are ready to burn all their cards. They pretend to be the custodians of the holy sites, that they are the protectors of Islam. And how would that work with normalizing with the Zionists? So until there is such a thing as the defeat of the Axis of Resistance, which will not happen, mm-hmm. the Saudis publicly right now will not normalize. And therefore, the recycling of their images is not going as fast as it should be.
It's interesting. And last question comes to you, John White. The recycling of the image of Saudi Arabia through Mohammed bin Salman, interesting way to put that. Do you think that has failed, especially at this point in juncture where the Saudis have not, they've had probably a covert relationship with Israel, but haven't come out and so-called normalized that?
Well, he can't, as my interlocutor eloquently puts it. He understands that as the guardians of the holy places, he can't afford to go to that step. But there is obviously a lot of backdoor cooperation in many ways, and Iran is the linchpin that holds that unholy alliance together. But when you talk about boosting his image, he has had some success. In 2019, so-called progressive newspapers in the West, such as The Guardian and Independent in the UK and The New York Times and others, accepted millions from the Saudis to promote the Saudi Arabian ads in their papers, right, over bin Salman's so-called reform agenda. And he's also sought to sportswash the image of his leadership as kleptocracy, okay, holding major sporting events such as heavyweight boxing matches and bouts, and obviously cultural events.
Sure.
And he has had some success. Some people have been bought, unfortunately, by this man. But I think as time goes on,
okay,
his real mantra will be revealed. He's an unreconstructed psychopath.
Thank you for that. Sorry to have jumped in. We're just fresh out of time. John White there from Edinburgh, writer and political analyst. Laith Maruf, a pleasure, from Beirut, activist and political commentator. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitalway and the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, today we're going to continue our discussion about Imam Khomeini's views on the armed forces. Please stay with us. The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes in his testament, "In Iran, where this miracle of the age, the Islamic Revolution, was worked by the people, the committed armed forces and the pure and patriotic commanders had a significant share. And today, as Saddam's war that has been imposed by the order and support of America and other superpowers has faced a political and military defeat by the invading Ba'athist army and its powerful supporters and their lackeys, it is again the armed forces and the new law enforcement forces, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps and popular forces, who created this great honour in the fronts with the unsparing support of the nation. They made Iran proud, and the internal mischief and plots that had been mobilised by the puppets affiliated to the East and the West to overthrow the Islamic Republic were thwarted by the able hands of the younger generation of the Islamic Revolutionary Committees, the Basij Volunteer Forces, the police, with the help of the brave people. It is the same dear selfness, younger generation, who stay awake at night so that their families rest calmly. May God bless them." The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, continues, "I recommend kindly to all armed forces, in the end of the life of this world, just as they have been loyal, to be firmly loyal to Islam, which is the only religion of independence and freedom, and Almighty God has invited all to the lofty human status with its light of guidance. It is Islam that rescues you, your country, and your nation from the strain of dependence and affiliation to the powers who do not want you, except for their slavery, and keep your dear country and nation backward and the consumption market and under the shameful oppression. Prefer noble human life, even with problems, to the shameful life of slavery of foreigners, even if it is with animal welfare. The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes further in his testament, "My brotherly recommendation in the final steps of my life to the armed forces generally is that, O dear ones, who love Islam and continue self-sacrifice in the France and all over the country with the love of meeting God, be vigilant and alert as the political players and the West-toxicated and East-toxicated professional politicians and stealthy, mysterious hands have focused the sharp weapon of treachery and crime from every side towards you, dear ones, more than any other group, and they want to exploit your dear ones, who have made the revolution victorious and revived Islam with your sacrifices to topple the Islamic Republic. And they want to separate you from Islam, and they want you to separate from the nation, and they don't want you to serve the country, and they want to throw you in the lap of one of the two world-devouring powers, and they want to nullify your efforts and sacrifices by political deception, tricks, in the Islamic and national form." Imam Khomeini then refers to the backwardness of Iran, saying, "After this, much of artificial backwardness to the great industries of the foreign countries, our need is an undeniable reality. This does not mean that we should be dependent on one of the superpowers in the advanced sciences. The government and the army should make effort to send committed students to the countries which have great advanced industries, while they're not colonialists and exploiters, and they should refrain from sending the students to America and the Soviet Union and other countries which are in the direction of these two poles. Perhaps, God willing, one day will come that these two powers will come to their senses and march in the path of humanity and humanitarianism and respect other people's rights. Or, God willing, the downtrodden of the world and the vigilant nations and committed Muslims will put them in their places." The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes further in his testament, "Know that as long as you extend your hand to others in advanced industries and spend your life in begging, the power of innovation and advancement in inventions would not flourish within you. And you saw clearly that in this short period after the economic sanctions, those who considered themselves unable to make anything and were disappointed of driving factories, put their thoughts into action and met many needs of the army and factories themselves. And this war, the economic sanction and expulsion of the foreign experts, were a divine gift, which we were negligent of. Now, if the government and the army sanctioned the goods of the world devourers and increased their effort in the way of innovation, it is hoped that the country will be self-sufficient and will be saved from begging the enemy." The late Imam Khomeini continued by saying, "We saw that many factories and advanced tools like aircrafts and other industrialized goods, which were not thought to be started by Iranian specialists, and all hands were extended towards the West and the East so that their specialists would start them. As a result of the economic sanction and the imposed war, Our dear young people have made the needed parts and supplied them in lower prices, and have proved that we can if we want to.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.